Welcome to the Gentleman Ultra Podcast. We bring nostalgia, history, and tales from both within and beyond Calcio's four white lines. This is Italian football through our eyes. This is the Gentleman Ultra.
Welcome to another edition of the Gentleman Ultra Podcast. I'm your host, Richard Hall, and today we'll be travelling through the football from its origins to the present day. We'll have a look at the trailblazers, the stars who came through, like Toto Scarlatti, and some unfortunate and wasted talent, potentially people like Alessio Curci. Now, wasted talent isn't something I would want to introduce my co-host as. He's, in fact, a star already risen. It's Luca Hodges-Ramon. How are you, Luca, and how nice was that intro?
Perfect intro. Very nicely done, Richard. Pleased to be back recording another episode of the Gentleman Ultra Podcast and looking forward to delving way back into antiquity, into culture antiquity today.
It's way back this time. So there is no Neil Morris today as he is in Spain over the hills and far away. But instead, we have a fabulous guest in Chris Lee from the Outside Right blog and podcast, which we are extremely fond of on this site. So, Chris, how are you? And before you get going, just tell the listeners if they don't know about your excellent site and of course, the podcast.
Brilliant. Well, thanks very much for having me on, guys. And it's great to be able to reciprocate because I know you both have been on mine, which is awesome. So, Outside Right is the Curious Fans blog, effectively. We talk about culture, history and travel in football. It's anything basically off the pitch. Part of this research, I've got a section I call Pioneers where I look at the people behind the game over on outsideright.co.uk, and that's right, WRITE. It's a play on words, and that section we're looking at very closely at the origins of the sport around the world, something I'm trying to put together into a book form eventually. I'm about halfway through, about 64,000 words now. And obviously the chapter on Italy is the one that I kind of summarized on your site. So that's what we'll be covering today. So the founding fathers of modern culture in Italy.
And I think it's excellent. I mean, you know, I love hearing on the podcast and on the site about the travels and the history. It's very attuned to what we do here as well. And I think, you know, when we travel to football, whether Italy obviously is what we talk about here, and whether that's Juventus, whether that's Milan, Genoa, Torino, There's always a story.
And yeah,
I think one of the things, I mean, don't really plug too much here for people who aren't, but I've just been reading Jonathan Wilson's Angels Dirty Faces.
Oh, that's brilliant. History,
brilliant book on Argentinian football. And again, I think the one thing that's commonplace in this is that in that the late 1800s, in the, you know, the rising sun, I suppose, still of the empire at that time, there was football was exported. It's all over the place, whether it's from the dock to the Bocca to the ports of Genoa. And you cover three different people and the founding fathers of football. And I think for our listeners, just explain a little bit for us, you know, why you chose these people, what sort of influence you think they had, and if you want to reference anything in comparison to, you know, what you found when you were writing this piece?
Do you know what? I've found new things since I wrote the piece. New and wonderful things. I had a history as part of my degree, and as historians, you just basically delve into the records and the archive, and you can really disappear down the rabbit hole if you ever looked at the British newspaper archive, for example. So it's just basically, you know, reading around the subject and understanding the context of the country at the time. And then what I found were these three characters, the preeminent characters that jumped out, and some peripheral figures as well, which we're going to cover as I go through it. But the key thing, though, to understand is obviously the context of the time. When we're talking about the game of association football, of course, arriving in Italy, we're looking at, like you said, the mid to late Victorian period, so the 1880s. When, as you mentioned, the British mercantile connectivity was global. It was the first sort of global empire, so to speak. This, but obviously, the countries that took up football weren't part of the empire. They were, you know, the Argentina, Uruguay, Brazil, Italy, Spain, Portugal, France. These countries that really took to football were not. They were just trading partners, effectively. And there were two routes that the game would leave England and Scotland as well. I have to say that Scots had a massive part in exporting the association rules game around the world. But the context of Italy at the time, as you know, in the 1880s, has only just been a unified country for a little over a decade and a bit. Luca, you know about the Risorgimento more than I do, but Italy for several centuries had been, you know, a peninsula, divided kingdoms, and been ruled over by different, you know, the Medici, Sforza, Savoia, you know, you name it, Borgia, right. Spanish, French, Napoleon, all sorts. They finally come together, but obviously, as now, there was a massive, like, you know, north-south divide, which is something that comes out quite early on in the history of football. But bit of context then, obviously it's a peninsula that's just become united. There's a lot of, it's way behind the rest of Europe developmentally, and it's hemorrhaging people, okay, to the Americas chiefly. So you talk about the port of Genoa, you're seeing millions of Italians during that period between the 1860s up to the 1920s, leaving the major ports, going to places like, you know, obviously the USA and Uruguay, Argentina, where there are so many Italians that they're actually infusing the language and the accent of those areas. And also, of course, as well, they may well have come across the game association football there first, because you're playing, like, Italy came quite late to football. I'm talking about like mid-1880s, whereas the game had been played, you know, the English were playing football in Buenos Aires in 1867. The French were playing at Le Havre in 1872. There was a club in Denmark in 1876. You know, so it was quite late. But there's typically with this, obviously you're familiar with the word calcio, which obviously means kick. And there is a reason it's called this rather than football or foosball, all the different kind of other languages adopted or localized the word. But the calcio, of course, is an Italian word, because there was already a kicking game in Italy. There were kicking games all around the world, from China to Mexico. But there was a kicking game called Calcio Fiorentino, which centered around, it was a 16th century game, which is still played. It's very violent, 55, I think it's 50 a side or something ridiculous.
It's 55, isn't it? It's like four different.
Something like that.
Just to interject quickly, there's a great piece by Chloe Beresford on the site on Calcio Fiorentino, if anyone wants some background on the kind of ins and outs and the peculiarities of that medieval sport, which still goes on today in Florence and is a crucial part of Florentine identity, definitely check that piece out on the website.
Yeah, and it's a 50-minute game. That's what threw me. It's 27 aside. They all dressed up, like I said, in this historical garb, and there's eye gouging, headbutts. It's all no holds barred. There's no substitutes either. So it's kind of like a it's very violent, but it was resurrected by Mussolini as part of his Making Italians mission. And they tried to dress up the association game as pretty much the English just reinvented the game. And here's the thing, I get this all the time, oh, the English didn't invent football. And it's like, yeah, there's a kicking game everywhere. Like I said, that Cuju in China has been played for 2,000 years, the Mexicans had a version. But you know what? The game that we play is the association rules game. It was codified after a collection of gentlemen got together in 1863, in, you know, the Freemasons Tavern in London, in Holborn, and they thrashed, at least put together the very first rule book that unified the various rules across from Cambridge, from Sheffield, wherever those other rules had been taken from, that people could get a consensus on. And as we know, within a decade, the people that preferred handling and hacking had gone off and formed the Rugby Football Union. And that went off in its own direction. But what we're talking about is the game that we play, which is association football. So that's just to sort of draw a line under that one. Just the context. In the 1880s in Italy, there's a guy called Eduardo Bossio. He's the son of a Swiss Italian brewer. He is in Turin, and he's just traveled up to Nottingham to work for a Thomas Adams, which is a lace maker in Nottingham. Nottingham at the time, for two decades had fairly strong footballing tradition. You had the Notts County Football Club, the world's oldest professional football club, which was formed in 1862 and was to eventually give its colours, as we know famously, to Juventus. And there's also Nottingham Forest, which has an Italian connection, and it was the very first team to wear red. And that red was called Garibaldi red, because obviously at the time, Garibaldi's followers were wearing red. So there's a little segue there. But this is where he got to know about football. He was a strong rower. He was something like 1 meter 81 tall or something. So he was quite tall for then, even in those days, when the average height is less than that now in modern Italy for a man. So he was quite physically strong. He liked rowing, et cetera, et cetera. But he got into football. And when he moved back to Italy, he decided to form a football club, which is where it all started. But who do you play with? He just kind of kick about amongst themselves, you know. But there was another guy, another team there at the time called Nobili Torino, which was formed by one of the counts up there. And they basically kind of merged as a team. And this is way before the current, the currently known oldest club in Italy, which is Genoa Cricket and Football Club, Genoa CFC, still going, of course. They were founded in 1893 as a British expats club in Genoa. And it's very much a British club for British people. And it was excluded foreigners, et cetera. And they were dealing with miners and coal trade, et cetera, and sailors and shipping various goods around from Italy back to the UK, or Britain, I should say, at the time. And into this environment, after Bossio, because Bossio is just doing his kick-arounds in Turin at this stage, is a guy who is intriguingly named, and ironically named, James Richardson Spenceley, who is from East London. I love that segue, that one century after James Richardson Spenceley rocks up in Genoa, there's another James Richardson introducing us to Italian football back home. But this Spenceley guy rocks up, joins the Genoa Cricket and the Athletic Club, as then known, forms a footballing branch of it in 1897. So it's still, it's quite a decade after Bossio, etc., has been doing the kick-arounds in Turin. But he he's really the driving force behind organising the game, because obviously he opens it up a little bit. He doesn't want it just for Brits anymore. He wants Italians to take part as well. So that he basically democratizes the game within the sort of Genoa, Liguria sort of region. Meanwhile, up in Turin, Bossio has brought a friend of his over called Herbert Kilpin, who I know you guys have done a lot on, because he was featured in a film called The Lord of Milan. He went on to form the Milan Cricket Football Club, now known as AC Milan. And by strange default, also formed Inter, and we'll come to that later on. But we got to this point where we've got the Genoa Cricket and Football Club now in 1897, looking for people to play. And Spenceley has to look north. He's heard there's clubs up in Turin that are playing at the minute. By this time, the club that both Spenceley, Kilpin and Bossio play for is called Internazionale di Torino, and they're playing in very attractive black and yellow stripes. It shouldn't be confused with the current Torino, of course, which was not formed until 1906. Decide to obviously get in contact and put together a game. So the first game takes place. It was arranged between Genoa CFC and the football club Torinese, as they were known, on the 6th of January 1898 in Genoa, with the visitors winning 1-0. Spenceley himself is the goalkeeper. I'm sure you guys have read John Foote's book, Calcio,
yes,
which touches on this subject. He records that first match. He found that 154 tickets were sold at the price of 1 lira. And 23 were sold at half price, so that 84 people paid extra for numbered seats, and the whole event made a profit over 100 lira. That's what he writes about the game, and we know a few things about this particular game. But basically, it leads to the formation of a league, effectively the first one, which is held at the Velodromo Umberto Primero, or Umberto Uno, what do you want to call him, in Turin, on the 8th of May in 1898. So it's a four-club tournament. It's one day. It's played over one day. They kick off at like 9 o'clock in the morning. So Internazionale beat Torinese in the first match. Genoa, with Spensley in goal and three other British players, they beat another team called Ginnastica from Turin as well in the second semi. Take a nice break for lunch. The final kicks off at 3 o'clock. Genoa then beat win the final with a 2-1 scoreline against Internazionale. So you've got people, these three, you've got Bossio, Spensley and Kilpin playing against each other. You know, these three kind of key founders. And it's the Duke of Abruzzi, who's he of the Nobili fame, who presents the trophy to Genoa. And that's effectively the first Scudetto, you know, in Italy's history. But it was really Spensley who was like driving this as a, you know, trying to form, get games and tournaments together. He went on to help form the Italian Football Federation, which went on to become known as the Federazione Italiana Gioco Calcio, FIGC, which of course is what it's known as today, Italianized in 1909. And by the sort of mid first decade of the 20th century, there's a very interesting person that helps drive a lot of the football in Italy and some of the first inter-European tournaments. And he is Sir Thomas Lipton of Lipton tea fame. Are you guys familiar with Lipton tea?
With the cup between Argentina and Uruguay.
Yeah, he was. He'd pioneered that a couple of years earlier. I think it was 1905 he started doing that. And he obviously saw that was successful. He was sponsoring other things. He was sponsoring sailing events as well. And that was the very first, kind of like you said, sort of tournament outside the British Isles, because they had obviously the home nations tournament between England, Scotland, Wales and Ireland. But Lipton took that to South America. And he also started, you know, two in Italy. So there was one in the north, which was famously, was made in a film called The Captain's Tale with Dennis Waterman in 1982, which recounts the story of the West Auckland football club from Northern League in England going down to Turin to play in 1909. They win. And they go back and they win it again in 1911, famously beating Juventus 6-1 in the final. And that's what, you know, becomes dramatised. And everyone thinks, oh, Juventus, wow, because of what they are now. But of course, Juventus then were, you know, one of many teams in that area who had won, I think, one national championship in 1905 at that point. You know, by the time this comes up. But he's sponsoring this tournament in the north. And there's one in the south as well, the Coppa Lipton, which features the Naples Cricket and Football Club, which goes on, of course, to become SS Napoli, and Palermo as well. So there's a few other teams from the south. So he's really galvanising, you know, support. And you see crowds growing, etc. And at this point, it's quite interesting. The game is becoming less of an English thing, more of a locals thing, because, as you can imagine, that just before World War One is where it all kind of capitulates anyway. Cricket is fizzling out as part of the summer game setup, and so people dropping cricket from their not only the curriculum but also their titles, and you're also getting the internationalisation of the sport. So when you get somewhere like Milan where they can't agree on whether to let in lots of foreign players, you get the Swiss players saying, well, do you know what, we'll form our own, which was Internazionale of Milan. So, you know, there's this sort of Italy's becoming, just getting its own identity just at the point where Il Duce is just about to, you know, come in the coming decade. And it's interesting on the eve of World War One, which is really where everything kind of changes, that Italy's almost becoming self-propelled as a kind of footballing nation. The game's catching on. It's getting its own kind of identity. And by World War One, we lose both both of the English guys. So Spensley himself, after, by the way, forming the... we said he was a bit of a driving force. He went and formed the scouting movement in Italy as well. So he's, you know, he's pretty dynamic. But he himself, as a doctor, is shot tending, ironically, to a German soldier on the Italian front in 1916, I think. And whereas Kilpin himself dies kind of in obscurity. I think he had a he died in 1916, I think, from alcohol, or it is thought. Whereas Bossier went on to live till 1927, by which time, as we know, we had a lot of other English coaches in, like William Garbutt at Genoa, who was the original Mister, which is why obviously it's, you know, coaches in Italy are known as Mister. And he won kind of the last of Genoa's titles, and before they kind of fizzled out and haven't won anything since. And then by, you know, 1934, as we know, Italy are world champions under Vittorio Nampozzo, who was the coach who was likewise learned his game in Switzerland, funny enough. So, sorry, go ahead, Richard.
No, at all. So please continue. I was going to ask, I've got a question for you, but I'll wait until you finish, of course.
No, that's pretty much it. The one thing I've missed out is that the one legacy of this, I suppose, that was really obvious to all of us, which is something we're going to touch on in its current form later on, of course, is the Azzurri, the way that Italy wear blue, where most national colours are the colours of the flag. So Italy theoretically should look like Mexico, red, white and green, but they don't. And the reason for that is because they have the Savoy blue, Savoy being the, you know, the nobility of the of this area where the game has taken place. So, you know, that's why they wear blue. And there's a piece on Gentleman Ultra around that as well.
It's incredible. It's an incredible piece because I think that, you know, often when we term nostalgia, we always dip back into those early 90s and late 80s. But obviously to go back to the very origins of the of football, not, you know, on the peninsula, it is fascinating because there's a lot of people, as you say, who came over and did some really amazing things. The question I've got for you, if that's okay, is that when you're researching this and when you look at people like Spenceley, I mean, you mentioned Garbutt, who's a bit later on, of course, but yeah, I use Spenceley as an example and keep to the Genoa theme, but these guys who were pioneers, they often didn't, it wasn't just football, was it? You said it before about the fact that these guys, he was a rower, someone that played cricket as well, spoke various languages. I mean, Spencer was a
reporter,
he was a reporter, he just seemed to do everything. And I think this, when you look, these guys who did this were of some real stature. I mean,
did you
find, because obviously I can look at it from an Italian point of view, like Luca here, and see there are a lot of similarities in the people who created the Italian game. But did you find the same similarities of these people of such great stature when researching elsewhere around the globe?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it takes really dynamic people. As you mentioned, Spenceley was not only a boxer and fluent in Greek and Sanskrit, of all languages. He wrote for the Daily Mail. And he, like I said, set up the scouting movement later on. And it takes a properly organised individual, driven individual to do that. He was relatively young because he arrived in January in 1896, aged 30. So he was doing a lot of it between his, 30 and 45, qualified doctor. So he was obviously, studious, intelligent. And when you look at the other sort of pioneers that took the game around the world, there's a real comparison with the Scotsman Mackay, William Alexander Mackay, who formed the Recreativo Huelva Club in Spain, which is Spain's oldest team. Because he was, again, a doctor, and highly educated, very driven, straight into, the local expat society that was, the British expats that were down in the south of Spain within a mining community. So the comparisons are incredible. And then he was very dynamic about getting games going with their nearest rivals, which were in Seville, where there's a club now it's Sevilla, still going, of course, who were formed just a matter of weeks after Huelva Club was. So it's... There's comparisons there. If you go down to South America, again, it's a Scotsman who's a schoolmaster that drives the game in Argentina. He set his own school up for a start, and then he decides helps set up the Argentinian League down there, which is the first league outside of the British Isles. So, yeah, it takes these pioneers, really driven individuals who are, organizers, can galvanize people, can really inspire people and teach them as well, I guess, because no one knows what to do with the ball. There's a lot of local opposition. Bear in mind, this is the Victorian era, and obviously the game faced different challenges wherever you go. So in Germany, everything was about gymnastics and Christian muscularity. And it was very much shunned that this ruffian English game, where they're getting their plus fours dirty in the mud while they're sort of throwing the ball around. It was very much looked down upon, frowned upon, whereas in Italy, I think it's more of a curio and very different setup because you didn't have, yeah, this is a game that started, let's not forget, in the middle and upper classes. It became a working man's game in the UK because of liberalised working hours and that people could free up the Saturday afternoon to go and watch and play football. But in other parts of the world, like in Italy, that wasn't the case. It was obviously, like you said, it was, you know, pretty working all the time apart from Sundays, you know. So it's only the gentlemen that get to play these things, which is why you get the teams like the nobility and expats playing it. But eventually it does, like you said, filter down and democratize. So
Chris, there's two really interesting themes that you've kind of touched upon in terms of these pioneers, their influence, specifically in Italy. One is actually the role they played in creating or furthering that sense of an Italian national identity by bringing the game and formalizing the game in Italy. Because, as you said, they formalized and institutionalized the game to create leagues both in the north and south, which, you know, if you've ever studied kind of theories of national identity, you need institutions, pastimes, cultures, traditions like this to kind of spread a shared sense of identity across the territory.
Yeah.
So clearly, as you said, off the back of the Risorgimento, when Italy has recently been unified by Garibaldi, you know, these pioneers like Spenceley, like Kilpin, Ozio, who are founding clubs, who are kind of formalizing rules and ensuring that clubs from across the country, obviously you eventually have the development of the North and South League, and the winners of each kind of play each other in a playoff final later on, almost spreads this idea that Italy has been unified as a country and there's something that unites Italians.
Exactly.
So I feel that's a really interesting dynamic to it, and you might want to comment on that further. And the second one is, you just mentioned there, is actually the kind of technicality and expertise of these individuals in the game of football itself. A lot of them obviously go on to be kind of player coaches or coaches themselves. Spenceley for Genoa, for example, you know, the image of him being the kind of chain smoking goalkeeper or coach at the same time. Same with Garbutt later at Genoa. I believe he kind of was the man who, as you said, the first, the term mister was coined after him because of his very proper English appearance, but also his, you know, his rigorousness in the training routines. He was the one who kind of brought individual fitness and tactics to the Italian game, or is credited with that. He, you know, even in terms of the actual facilities, the installation of hot showers in the dressing room, they formalized and also brought expertise to the Italian game. I just wonder what your kind of thoughts are on those particular two influences.
Well, I mean, you've hit the nail on the head, and it's Rory Smith's book, Mister, which covers this. It's basically it's the guys that left England and Scotland because they couldn't get the training gigs, you know, the coaching gigs, because they were thinking differently. They weren't doing the accepted ways of doing things, which has always been English and Scottish football's problem, which is why they didn't compete and win early trophies and have playing catch up for decades. Because these great thinkers went abroad, people like Garbutt, and they went and they helped other countries become, you know, tactically astute. Now, you look at Italy now, you think of Catenaccio, don't you? And always think of tactics and craft and guile around the Italian game. You know, you think of Germany with tactics as well, for example. So there's always, you know, these national attributes that you would associate with a particular country, chiefly because of the way they play football. And it's this early period that we're really finding the Italian mentality and style of play taking place. The English game was quite individual back in the late Victorian era. It was a lot of dribbling. It was the Scots that invented the passing game. And it's, you know, the whole way that each country developed does, like you said, help stamp an identity. But I think with Italy as well, I think, imagine forming the country as a country. I guess the communications weren't that great then. And as you know, still now, there's still this regionalism that goes on. So, I mean, I remember going to Empoli last season, And I was saying, oh, so your nearest club is, you know, Fiorentina, so surely they're your nearest rival. So they're kind of one of us. They're obviously, you know, from Tuscany, we're fine, we're cool with them. We'd rather have a rivalry with someone next door, like, you know, Pisa or Livorno or someone that invaded us 400 years ago. So they still have this kind of, you know, this sort of like mentality. And I guess that sort of prevails. But that was one of the challenges you mentioned they were trying to overcome in those days.
I always say that Italian football or calcio, it unites and divides Italy in that sense, depending on the circumstances. But that is fascinating. And I think the other thing to bear in mind about these figures is that the sense of history that they created and the origins of these clubs are very keenly remembered and celebrated by the fans today. So we're not talking about abstract figures.
No.
But genuine kind of heroes at clubs. So Kilpin, obviously, at Milan is recognised as the founding father. And obviously you had that magnificent choreography by the Curva Sud.
Yes.
Celebrating Kilpin's contribution to AC Milan. We had an article on the website by Matt McGinn, who actually went with some distant relatives of Herbert Kilpin to Milan to retrace his steps and interviewed a number of club supporters, club officials who had taken massive steps to try and make sure that Kilpin was remembered and celebrated for the role he played. I mean,
it's easy to forget. I mean, that's the thing. It's because it is, we're talking about nostalgia on this program, but it's kind of, this is beyond nostalgia. This is like the origins. And so none of us are going to remember this. And like you said, even great-grandparents wouldn't necessarily remember this. But the Kilpin, like you said, he was laid undiscovered for decades. You know, he was died in obscurity and was rediscovered in the late 90s, early 2000s. And he's now since been moved into Cimitero Monumentale. So he's got a proper sort of grave. He has an ultra sect named after him, as does Spensley. So these guys' stories are being told again, which is really great. And they probably didn't even think of it. So they were both modest guys. You know, they weren't like, you know, they were friends. They were obviously rivals on the pitch sometimes, but namely in the first championship. But they wouldn't see themselves as like, well, I've got to, you know, I want to be remembered as the founding father of Italian football. They just thought they were just trying to evangelize the game and get people playing it because they wanted to play more games themselves. And they really believed in it. And that's the difference. I think that's what's the key thing to remember. But the legacy does leave on. Just want to sort of make the point that when we go to Marassi and we go to that beautiful stadium, Luigi Ferraris. Ferraris himself was a Genoa player who was killed in action in World War I, along with Spensley. So he, likewise, his pre-World War I legacy of Genoa is still goes on.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's interesting because, like you say, a lot of these players, they just wanted to play football. There's no, you know, that was the key point of it. And the legacy that's happened after that is fantastic of the way it's grown and evolved, but it was never the intention. And Luke, you mentioned then that United Italy in some respects in those years since. And so with that note in mind, I think the next time I can think of that football united Italy in such a way and probably culminated in such majesty and respect was Italia 90. And that sort of moves us on a little bit from quite a few years, should we say, at least 100 plus, 100 or so.
Skip forward a long way.
Yeah, just a little bit. And it's because the reason I'm saying nothing about Italia 90 is because we've had a piece on here by Youssef, which is called The Making of a Golden Boy, Toto Scarlacci's breakout season at Juventus. And Luke, I'm going to come to you on this, but for me, it always touches my heart with Italia 90 because it was my first World Cup. And I don't think, even if you don't remember the games, to the images of Toto Scarlacci and what that meant to the nation, especially when players like Cannavale had gone up front to play as they're one of the key strikers, and you look at people like Viali who was there, and there was a strong squad, and yet still this small boy from Messina, well, man at the time, had come on. And the memories there were fantastic because it wasn't meant to be him. And sometimes I, looking back, get so involved about Italia 90, the goal, the header against Austria, the amazing ball under the legs, I think, from Baggio, and then Scarlacci lobbing the Uruguayan keeper from 20 yards and getting on the end of Paki Bonner's mistake and all of these different goals, and then the atmosphere and everything that whipped up and into a frenzy, and they were so close. And even to the point of where in that penalty against England, right in the third place playoff in Bari, when Peter Shilton made an epic mistake, and how sad he looked even to score that because the dream was over. You know, Scalacci brings back a million memories, but one thing that this piece was really interested me was, obviously, I think that's the point, he was an unknown even then. And when I say unknown, I mean, you know, you've got to take into respect that even now, and we'll go on to talk about a young boy that's going to play for Italy soon, but even in social media and everything that gets hold of a young, talented player, everyone knows every single thing about him in moments now. But really then, you know, this guy had one season at Juventus. But Luca, for me, what do you think? From that time, the season before, the World Cup, everyone knows World Cup's in 90. This is an outside choice, isn't it, for Scalacci to go? Because when you look at the strikers in Italy at that time, why Scalacci?
Yeah, and I think that's what this piece really tries to get to the heart of is how did Scalacci almost rise from obscurity, as you say, Richard, in the space of basically what was a year, maybe a year and a half, 2 years, to be selected for the Italian national team for the World Cup. And Yusuf writes this piece on his breakout season at Juventus in 89-90, which came off the back of a successful season at Messina. Obviously, Scalacci himself is Sicilian, had a successful season in Serie B with Messina, where he finishes capocannoniere, top scorer in Serie B with 23 goals. And, you know, this catches the eye of Dino Zoff, the then Juventus mister or coach, head coach, who, I guess, for a bit of context here, it's relevant to say that this is a bit of a transition period for Juve. We're not talking about the dominant kind of Juventus that we are accustomed to now in the late 80s. Obviously, you had the Maradona of Napoli, you had Sacchi's Milan, and they're coming off the back of, you know, the kind of 80s under Trapattoni with Juventus, where they dominated and they kind of fell off a little and have entered into a transition period, really. And under Dino Zoff, who manages to qualify for the UEFA Cup with Juventus in the 88-89 season, he looks to reinforce his squad by adding players up front, and he sees a kind of bargain, I guess, what you would call today a bargain in Scalacci, a guy who's scored goals in Serie B, proved he's hungry, and he's paired him up front with Pierluigi Casiraghi, who a lot of people again will recognise a name who went on to have great success, albeit curtailed by injury. So Zoff pairs Scalacci and Casiraghi up front together for the 89-90 season. And Scalacci just basically hits the ground running and is a massive hit. Goes on to score 21 goals in total throughout that season, 15 come in the league. And we're talking about here at a league where you've got Sacchi's Milan, Maradona's Napoli, really at their peak, challenging for the title. And so it's no kind of mean feat for Scalacci to score 15 league goals, I think it was in the end, against some of obviously the toughest defences in the world as well. Perhaps more impressively as well, Juve that year go on to achieve a double. They win the Coppa Italia and the UEFA Cup, most significantly in that famous final against Fiorentina, obviously, which kind of precipitated Baggio's move to Juventus, that controversial move in the end. But Scalacci again plays a very important role in that UEFA Cup run. He's actually Juventus's top scorer in the competition. I think he scores 4 goals. Juve come through a string of hard games against German opponents, Hamburg notably, and FC Cologne, before finding their opponents Fiorentina in the final. And so, as you said, it really was quite a remarkable story, because within the space of a season and a half, if you like, is you can get out, it's kind of success at Messina. But it's very rare, obviously, that a Serie B player would be selected for the international side, which will bring us nicely on to who we're going to talk about later. But in terms of Scilacci and his surprise breakthrough, if you like, through from Messina and Serie B to Juventus that season, which culminated in him being called up for Italian 90 and obviously becoming the golden boy of Italian 90, winning, you know, the top scorer award, the golden ball and the golden boot, the player of the tournament. Chris, what are your memories first of Scilacci as a player? But also, I guess, how difficult it is or how surprising it is for a player to take that route into a World Cup or into a national team.
Yeah, I mean, talk about one-hit wonders. I mean, he's one of the ones that you'd think about. And I, a little bit like Richard, it was my second World Cup. I remember Mexico 86 in great detail. But I was properly sort of, you know, compass mentis early teen by the time that Italian 90 came around. But I wasn't aware of him beforehand. And he was fairly down the pecking order, wasn't he? If you think about the other strikers they had at their disposal, like you said, Cannavale would have been the main choice, and Serena and Viali. And so it was only really because these guys were drawing blanks early on that, you know, he had to turn to Scilacci, and the rest is history, so to speak. But I did an interview with Simon Hart, who wrote World in Motion, which is the insider story really of Italian 90. So he speaks to a lot of players. I mean, I think, you know, about their experience and their memories of the tournament, which are very pivotal in world history, as we were talking about earlier, in the history of the game anyway. And, you know, it's like, what would you rather be? A guy with a long career who people kind of, you know, who talks about Miroslav Klose? Hardly anyone. He's yet the World Cup's top scorer. But everyone remembers Salvatore Scilacci because he's, you know, he's just, he turned up, he got his golden boot and he I think he went off to Japan, didn't he, after that, and he kind of he ran the soccer school in Palermo. But I would just going back to the other thing, when we talk about Italian 90 and Italian unification, I do think that tournament exposed a lot of fissures in the national identity, and that culminated in the semi-final of Italy against Argentina in Napoli, which I thought was an interesting choice of venue, given they played in Rome for all the games up to this critical point. Because why wouldn't you host it in Turin or, you know, San Siro or somewhere which is big enough and, you know, safe enough, I guess, because Napoli, the venue, enabled their local star, Diego Maradona, to actually turn around and say, look, most of this year, these guys ignore you. Now they want you to play Italian. So he managed to sort of force some kind of regional division ahead of that game, which was not necessarily, you know, pivotal in changing support, but it did kind of was a good bit of pre-match psychological one-upmanship, put a lot more pressure on the Azzurri than they could have, you know, needed necessarily. But there you are. That's my overarching memory. And unfortunately, that day, that's when it all came undone because of the lack of goals from other parts of the team. Scilacci was the one that got them there, really.
Yeah, it's the most Italian thing to do, isn't it? You know, perform brilliantly. They conceded a goal up until then, and then the choice of venue, really, they couldn't have made it any worse in that tournament for that time. I mean, Scilacci, of course, scoring in that semi-final as well.
Mm-hmm.
And as you say, you know, very much almost a one-hit wonder and coming from nowhere. And it's a great article, so please, if anyone hasn't read it yet, just go on the site and have a look for Yusuf's article on Scilacci. A quick question to both of you now, and probably posing it in the basis that Italy are about to play at the time of recording the Portugal in the Nations League this weekend. And Mancini has been quite bold with some of his selections, criticised some of his selections as well. Obviously, they lost the first game 1-0 with a very young squad. He's trying to reshape the Azzurri. He's trying to create something that's based around performances, which we saw against Poland recently. But on his call-ups at the moment, Sandro Tonelli from Brescia has been called up. This 18-year-old, seen as the new Pirlo. And I suppose Scilacci, in some respects, draws that comparison, you know, when we're talking about the unknown. But this is a different level of unknown, isn't it? I mean, okay, the guy looks like Pirlo, acts like Pirlo in the sense of, because he's from Brescia and he's got the you know, wears a Brescia kit. So it's obvious to visually, aesthetically, it seems like Pirlo reborn, and because he plays the same position. Now, just how much do you guys feel when? Because we have a habit in England, as you know, that to anyone with the smallest semblance of talent is to rise them up to the top and then completely crush them when they don't perform. How do you feel this is going to go? I mean, obviously, we're expecting to potentially play against the US rather than against Portugal, despite Mancini saying, being waxing lyrical about him this week and saying that, you know, he's incredibly talented and anyone who impresses me in the week will play. First of all, guys, is this almost like a too big a rising for a player who obviously is multi-talented considering who he's linked to? Because, I mean, we're talking about Scalacci appearing at a World Cup after, but let's face it, even though it wasn't the top Juventus team, still Juventus. Mm. But this is 30 appearances for Brescia, and next thing you're on the global stage. I mean, what are your thoughts, guys? Is this a step a little too quick for Tonelli?
Luca, do you want to go first?
Yeah, I'll go first. I think it really depends on how Mancini decides to use him. I don't see, although Mancini obviously is saying that whoever impresses him in training or who has impressed him in training this week will play against Poland. I don't see Tonali breaking into a midfield, into the central midfield area, especially when Jorginho is the man really occupying the position. Pellegrini's been doing well as well. Berardi obviously is another man he'd be competing with. I don't see him breaking into a kind of competitive game like that. Obviously, as you said, Richard, he might be used in the friendly against the US. And I think part of the thinking behind that is to expose him to the national team set up as early as possible. Clearly, Mancini has it in his mind that Tonali is going to be part of the setup for a long time. So some experience in his very early years certainly won't do him any harm. And learning from some of the experienced pros in the setup, it is a young side and Mancini is looking like he's trying to kind of change the direction. Now, I think we finally saw with that last Poland game, a clear attempt to forge an identity, a new identity for Italy under Mancini, and also some consistency rather than chopping and changing the personnel from game to game. So a more stable environment will help a young player like Tonali. It is very much, even though we've clips of him on YouTube or watched the odd Brescia highlights here and there from Serie B, watched the odd game, and you can see the kind of comparisons with Pirlo in the way he plays as that deep line midfielder, his passing range, his specialism from set pieces. But also he has another element to his game in being a kind of destroyer in that deep lying role, winning the ball back gracefully, as gracefully as possible sometimes, actually. Maybe not quite in the style of Gattuso, who I think he himself, Sandro Tonali himself, has kind of said he looks to in terms of a model as well. But I think at this stage, yeah, it's very early days. It is right to get excited about young players. We do it in England, as you said, Richard, and the latest two are kind of Jadon Sancho, Mason Mount, who was called up from the Championship, from the second division in England. So, you know, Serie B and some first team experience with Brescia, some will question whether that qualifies you to be called up to the national team. But if this kid has the talent, and as we've seen with someone like Scalacci, you know, Serie B can be a very good starting point for a very successful, well, in Scalacci's case, it wasn't a very successful career, it was a very successful year. Then why not expose him to the environment and see how it progresses?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the one thing I would feel sorry for is Sense. That's one of the Sense he's also been called up and it's been completely overshadowed. But, I mean, what's your thoughts, Chris? I mean, I know sometimes we get excited about certain players and probably sometimes a little bit too much, but Luca's got a point. We can watch YouTube highlights of this, and I think that's maybe what makes it exciting as well, because we don't really know what he's like, because very few will have watched him week in, week out.
Yeah, and he's been playing against Serie B opposition, so it's kind of... I think this is all part of Mancini's reboot, effectively, Italian national team. There's a lot of emphasis on youth. If you look at the experience in there, you've got Bonucci and Chiellini at the heart of defence. But, you know, elsewhere, and obviously Jorginho, which is the top passer, I think, in the Premier League at the minute. So it's kind of, you know, you have this experienced hub, and then it's kind of filtering in those younger players around the experienced ones to make sure that effectively the next generation in 2-3 tournaments time is in a position to compete. And I think that's where it's really important to blood young players, whatever division they're in. If they're talented enough and they can step up, then that's great. I think we do, the problem with youth is it either sinks or swims a lot of the time. You think of players that are kind of started young, like Ravel Morrison and people like that sort of just disappeared. And, you know, it's like you've got these talents that can make it or not make it. So I think you have to sort of trust them and throw them into the lion's den, and the ones that will make it and have the skill, discipline and willingness to learn. I think it's great opportunity for Tonali.
No, absolutely. I think we've covered quite a lot today in that sort of point, in the sense of, you know, you can be brave with your choices, but I mean, we've especially for the national team, but we've seen this before. I mean, like I said before, we've got a lot of instances in the UK where people have been built up or and ultimately failed, and we could use that on a comparison again, you know, with Scalacci in a sense, even though he did have his moment. But just before we go, just one thing I'd reference point in there, and it's another article by Youssef, is Alessio Cerchi and his article, Youssef's article, The Regrets of a Wasted Talent. I suppose, you know, Cerchi, for me, when I saw him at Torino, I was so excited about this. This is one of the players that when he started off, I think it was at Atalanta, it was just incredible. He looked as if he was going to be the next big thing. And yet another player who ultimately fell off. Well, just before we go, I mean, I just wanted to sort of point out this article, because it's another great one by Youssef, but what are your quick memories of Alessio Cerchi, and why didn't it work?
The Torino season, obviously, with Immobile, is the season that people will always reference and look back at as being the kind of benchmark of what he could have achieved had he found consistency and settled down. Obviously, after that, he got his big move to Atletico Madrid, and that didn't work out at all. And he speaks kind of about the regret of, I guess, taking the wrong decision at that time and moving to Atletico Madrid, where under Diego Simeone, it just didn't work out. That, without doubt, that season where we helped steer Torino ultimately to UEFA Cup qualification, and formed an awesome partnership playing just off Ciro Immobile. Was a snapshot really of the talent that Cerchi had, especially with that left foot, a very cultured left foot that he had. But as you said, it never really worked out. He spent a lot of time on loan, played at big clubs in Italy, Roma, Fiorentina, never quite managed to settle down or find his place in a team. And so I guess, as you said, it's actually a good example of a player, of the dangers of building up a player who is kind of touted as one of the next breakout stars, but ultimately either too much pressure being heaped on shoulders, or just a kind of, I guess, a lack of the psychological side of what it takes sometimes to really push on and fulfil that talent.
If it's any consolation, he's great in FIFA.
You mentioned it was Roma he started out as. I think I just have any young player and automatically put him at Atalanta in my head, which is what I said before. So, I mean, apart from being good on FIFA, what do you think, Chris? I mean, at the end of the day, that doesn't matter a little.
That is my, I'll be honest with you, that's my only exposure to him. I just looking at his record, like you said, to be that much of a journeyman, it's difficult, isn't it? You want to sort of feel at home somewhere. It looks like, looking at his stats, it looks like the middle of his career between 2010 and 2014 at Fiorentina and Torino was his most consistent years delivery, but that's because he was there for a couple of years, a couple of seasons each piece, you know. He wasn't being loaned out to Pisa and Atalanta and things like that. He was settled. So I guess that's what probably would have been best for him.
So I think we've pretty much covered everything from pioneers to young hopes to regrettable failures there, but Before we go, Chris, is there anything that's coming up with your site and podcast that you want to just tell us about? Because I really feel that anyone who listens to this podcast or reads our site will feel just at home with The Outside Right.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah, I mean, the next one coming up is I'll be talking about the past, present and future of Juventus, which I didn't really talk about in this, you know, very much in the historical piece. And if you're interested in other countries, my very next podcast will be about football during the Spanish Civil War, which is in itself intriguing and helped form the current status of clubs like Real Madrid and Atletico de Madrid, which nearly went out of business. So and Barcelona as well nearly went out of business. So these are it's not Italy, but it's something different.
I've definitely been listening out for that one.
And where can people find your podcast and yourself on Twitter?
We're on iTunes, Stitcher and Anchor, of course, and Outside Right, WRITE.co.uk, and on Twitter, Instagram and Facebook, just look for Outside Right.
Great stuff. And Luca, is there anything you want to talk about our site that's coming up, or should we, well, I suppose we can say we have a little trip planned, don't we, in the new year ourselves, talking football travels?
Yeah. So I guess that is the kind of biggest upcoming event is in January, early January. We are going to get out to Italy to hopefully take in two or three fixtures, depending on what the fixture list does to us. We're still hoping it's kind to us in terms of allowing us to travel a little bit. And hopefully we will be documenting our travels and putting some content out there as a result of that. So obviously we're very much looking forward to the new year. And in the meantime, a couple more podcasts and articles coming through. That will be one to look out for.
Great stuff. And we'll try and do a podcast live from Italy. But if you've heard the technical difficulties we had on that one, don't expect much from that. Okay.
I've had a bit of a shock for these last few weeks. So let's hope the new year will bring new fortunes for the podcasting anyway.
Well, thanks for having me on, guys.
Cheers, Chris.
See you guys.
Thanks a lot.
Bye.